questions. There are probably more than I will be able to respond to. I've always approached mindfulness of mind as something in the mind, rather than something felt bodily. Until the other day, when the mind's awareness felt like it was being known somatically, like the body was the awareness antenna. Does Sayadaw speak of this at all, or anything like it? Well, the short answer to the question is, I don't know, but I'll go further than that. I'll speak from my own experience with this kind of thing, with this kind of experience. The experience of being aware of mind, the mental functioning, there's definitely a sense, at least in my experience at times, not always, sometimes it's more, seems purely what I might call mental, but often it is related to or connected to, in particular, sensations in the visceral area of the body. And I understand this partly as the very close connection between this visceral area and our nervous system. That when we feel into what's happening, so that the experience, for instance, of wise mindfulness or awareness with wise attitude, there's a feeling often that's a kind of a in this area of the body, in the visceral area, the area of the heart, there's a feeling of openness and softness when there is awareness with constriction in the mind. Often that is also felt in this area in the body. The heart may feel tight, the stomach, I don't know whether this is strictly mindfulness, you know, a mindfulness of mental experience, or whether it's kind of got an in-between kind of quality. But I do know in Burma, and this might have come up in one of the groups or sometime, they don't make such a distinction in terms of mental somehow being up in the area of the brain and a physical being, the body, kind of the physical body. Because at one point, Sayadaw Upandita, in talking to me about exploring intention, he said, the intention arises in the mind, so watch the mind. It's located in your chest, just to left of center. So that's a different perspective than we have necessarily in the West. But feeling into that area, and you're just like letting my attention be in this area, you know, because like I think in the West we tend to think of awareness as up here somewhere, up in the head. And playing with the sense of where awareness is located, letting my attention like drop into this area and feeling that area of the body, what I think of as body, feeling this area, there can be a kind of a sensing of the movement towards intention. Is it physical? Is it mental? What I mostly say is, notice your experience. I would encourage not making or reifying anything around it. So the sense of you know, this awareness antenna, that's one way. And certainly it is in, you know, it is this person's experience of that possibility of awareness having that sense. So trust that, and then don't make a story about it that that's the right way, because there are other times, other ways we can have the sense of awareness. Maybe times where it doesn't feel like it's involved with the body. And so, but in this case, it does sound like it's helpful in a way to let the mind play with the perception of awareness being located in the body, rather than whatever we think of as mind. In my own exploration around awareness, you know, it's like what I've come to is that awareness itself has no location. The experience of awareness being located somewhere is a perception. The experience of awareness being located in the mind or in the head, in the brain or whatever, it's somewhere up here, like we're looking out from the, you know, from the head, you know, being, perceiving out from the ears and out from the eyes. That's a perception, one that's been reinforced perhaps by our culture. We can play with the location of perception. It can be something we can just be flexible about, just like, okay, well, it kind of feels like the awareness is up here coming out of my head. Can I play with bringing the attention down into the area of the heart and see if I play with the awareness being located here, how does that affect the experience? What if I play with the idea that awareness is as big as the room, not located in the body at all? There was one teacher who in instructing another student, a colleague of mine, who described that when I told them about what Upandita said, awareness, you know, the mind is located in your chest, slightly left of center. He said, well, my teacher told me that awareness was located about 6 inches in front of my chest. Something like that, you know, located here. So that can be another perception, you know, not in the body. And I've played with this perception of like no location, just like playing with the sense of an expansiveness of awareness. So, just those are some reflections on that. Did the Buddha have any teachings about mental illness or non-accident physical challenges? If not, do you have any thoughts of what he might say? There are some words in the suttas that I can refer to, and I will, with respect in particular to physical dukkha. Not much about mental illness that I'm aware of, although there's one thing I'll mention. But again, how I'll kind of respond to this is, I just want to first say, I have no idea what the mind of the Buddha would say with this question. So I can only say what I understand based on my processing of what the teachings that I have received are. So the answer does not come from the Buddha. So first, looking at the physical challenges. And one thing I think that's helpful to just reflect on is what is being asked about here is dukkha. Maybe the Buddha kind of parsed the world in different ways or something, you know, I don't know how ancient India understood mental illness. But physical challenges certainly were happening at the time of the Buddha, you know, leprosy and death and accidents and injuries, you know, all kinds of physical challenges. He had a bad back. And he spoke a lot about working with the challenges of that, but it was like, you know, direct to suffering. The teachings that he offers seem to go direct to the place where clinging and craving are. So here's an example. And this is an exchange between Ananda Pindika, who is basically dying. I believe he's on his deathbed. Can't tell, just in a quick scan of it. And so Shariputra goes to Ananda Pindika and is asking, concerned about Ananda Pindika, saying, "I hope you're getting better. I hope you're feeling well." And Ananda Pindika says, "I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent." And Shariputra gives him a little Dharma talk. And it's a page and a half of text in here, his response. You know, it's a lot of words. But it's basically, the flavor of it is, the training in not clinging. He says, you should train thus. I will not cling to the eye. Consciousness will not be dependent on the eye. I will not cling to the ear, etc. I will not cling to form. I will not cling to feelings. I will not cling to ear contact, eye contact. I will not cling to form. I will not cling to the base of infinite space. I will not cling to this world. I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. The first time I heard this teaching, it kind of startled my mind. The description of his experience here is, just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, violent winds cut through my head. Just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so there are violent pains in my head. Just as if a skilled butcher were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly. Just as if two men were to seize a worker by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals, so too there is violent burning in my body. And I thought, if that was my experience, I wouldn't be clinging to the body. And this kind of was a little koan for me for the next 48 hours of that retreat. And in looking at my own experience, because I am, you know, in the aversive camp, so unpleasant experience is kind of my go-to thing. And what I began to understand is that I do cling to unpleasant experience. I cling to it in order to get rid of it. It's as if the unpleasant experience, this water bottle being an unpleasant experience I'm holding in my hands, it's as if this mind is holding on tightly to this water bottle, trying to figure out how to put it down, how to get rid of it, how to throw it away. That is clinging to that unpleasant experience. So in terms of physical pain, the Buddha had this very profound medicine of looking at the aversion, looking at the clinging. You know, the clinging is the aversion really here. And training in non-aversion, which is, you know, as we've been exploring and recognizing, we don't just flip a switch and say, oh, I won't be averse to my racking, burning pains in the body. But we notice that aversion. We know the unpleasant and the aversive mind. And maybe that the mind can know that. The wisdom of the system can begin to point to the way aversion is optional. Aversion might fall away at times. And then we begin to see that the unpleasant experience is just unpleasant experience. The kind of poignant next piece of this teaching, or the text as a whole, was that Ananda Pindaka was weeping after this Dharma talk. And Shariputra asked him, are you sinking? Are you sinking? And Ananda Pindaka said, no, I'm not sinking. But though I have long waited upon the teacher and the bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma. Ananda Pindaka was a lay person. And Shariputra replied, such a talk on the Dhamma householder is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dhamma is given to those who have gone forth. Ananda Pindaka said, well then, Venerable Shariputra, let such talk as the Dharma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are those with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk on the Dhamma. There will be those who understand the Dhamma. And so we actually owe a debt of gratitude to Ananda Pindaka for pointing this out. To the Buddha, to Shariputra, and through Shariputra, I assume, to the Buddha. I don't know of the follow-on story there. Curious about that, whether there's a little note in there about that, but I didn't look that up. But in any case, we know that the Dhamma is now given to lay people. The talk on the Dhamma is given to lay people. And so, to me, that's a very kind of poignant thing about this particular teaching. But again, the medicine that the Buddha offers is just straight to look at the clinging. You're experiencing physical pain. Look at the clinging. The the mental illness question, I don't think I'll even, I'll offer this one example that I know is in the suttas, but I think I'll just set it aside in terms of what the Buddha might say, because I have no idea. There's a lot that Western psychology integrated with mindfulness has to say about this, but that's a huge topic. But there's one teaching that's also kind of poignant, that there was a person who joined the order. And he has to join the order. I can't quite remember all the details, but he had a little bit of not quite a lot of, what would the right word be? He wasn't so sharp, you know, kind of slow. I think maybe they called him slow-witted or something like that in the suttas. So he was unable to remember the rules, for instance, of the monastics. And the Buddha, I think this is the same teaching. I may be conflating two stories, but the Buddha, you know, when he expressed distress that he wouldn't be able to remember all of the monastic rules, the Buddha gave him one rule to remember. He said, well, can you remember one rule? And he said, yes, I can remember one rule. And he said, remember non-harming. And so that was one instruction that he offered this person. And then the other, in terms of the kind of the mindfulness, the purifying the mind, the complexity of meditation instructions, the Buddha seemed to have a sense or an understanding of what kinds of instructions would be helpful for people, and had a that this seemed this is one of the amazing qualities of the Buddha, that he seemed to know exactly the teaching that anyone would need in a moment, in a given moment. And so in terms of helping this person to purify their mind, to settle the mind into concentration, he gave him a white cloth and said, just rub this cloth between your fingers. And in doing that, the story goes that as he rubbed the cloth between his finger, he noticed that it got dirty, that it got stained from the oils on his fingers. And that triggered something, sparked something in his mind about how the mind attaches to things or gets confused and defiled. It doesn't describe how this understanding happened. But the Buddha, the Buddha, in compassion for this person, gave him a very simple practice to do that would help him to wake up. And so, that's some of the mythology of the Buddha, in a way, that he knew exactly the teaching to give to people who came to him and said, I would like teaching. Oh, I remember another story. Story of a woman who eventually became a nun, basically went mad through the loss of her two children, her husband, and her parents, all in the space of one night. And she was kind of wandering around deranged, and people were trying to keep her away from the Buddha. She was wandering around in the place where the Buddha was, and people were trying to keep her away from the Buddha. And he understood she had the capacity to wake up, and he said, no, let her come near. She was kind of like, half clothed, and somebody gave her a robe or a sheet to put around herself. And he said, recover your mindfulness. That woke her up. So again, just knowing the teaching, how to meet someone. But as far as I know, no descriptions of, well, here's how you can work with people with this kind of mental illness and this kind of mental illness. The stories are very specific to specific instances. The variety and depth and breadth of my conditioning seems to be hardwired into my mind. Institutional delusions constantly reinforce these. So many things to keep track of. In practice, I often feel like I am taking one step forward, only in the next moment to take two steps back. Or like whack-a-mole, how to move forward without losing hope. I find this a very poignant question. This feeling of practice being two steps forward, one step forward, two steps back, this is not uncommon in the way people describe their experience. And in the realm of social conditioning, the patterns and habits of our culture, the ways that our culture reinforces our delusion. It's hard. It's hard to see these things. But what I would say here is that the experience, perhaps, of taking two steps back or of kind of being brought up short, the idea that it steps back, I think, is a misunderstanding. We, in many areas of our practice, when it feels like we're not making progress or we're coming up against something challenging, we're butting up against something difficult, it feels like we're taking steps back, but that's the growing edge. That's the place where learning is happening. We're running into areas. It's like we've wandered into new terrain. If we're wandering around a landscape, you know, walking, it's like at some point we're going to run into some kind of the terrain that we're not familiar with. We may have to slow down a little bit. We may have to learn something about this new landscape. It's an opportunity when we find ourselves in that place where it feels like, I have no idea how to be with this. I have no idea how to respond to this situation. That's an opportunity. If we don't just chalk it up to like, failure, it's instead of being a failure, it's a pointer to something new to be learned. Those places, those times where we, the Buddha taught his son when he was 7 years old, he taught him to engage in the world through checking in before he acted. Is it going to cause suffering for himself or others or both? You know, checking into what he knows, what he understands about the world. And if it looks like, or if he sees or understands it's not going to cause affliction for self or other or both, then he should go ahead and do that action. It's fine to do that action. But then he should not just stop there. He should watch while he's acting and check in. Is it causing harm? Is it causing affliction? If it is, the Buddha says, stop. Stop doing that. If it's not, if you do not see that happening, not affliction not being caused, continue. And he doesn't stop there. He says, after the action is over, if it has caused harm, he says, undertake restraint in the future. And elsewhere, there are teachings around making amends when we have caused harm. Not in that particular sutta, so this kind of encouragement, it's an encouragement to check in, what's my intention before I act, while I'm acting, and then to see what's the impact, so that we don't just assume that acting from an intention not to cause harm won't cause harm. We actually look at that feedback. You know, I take this teaching as very much an intention impact teaching that the Buddha offered his son. Check out the impact. How does it affect? You know, you have this intention of maybe helping or supporting, and yet check it out. Don't just assume that everything's good, right? And so this is a teaching on learning from our mistakes. The Buddha didn't say to his son, you know, beat yourself up and tell yourself a bad person. He said, undertake restraint in the future. Stop doing actions that you see cause harm. And I would add, learn from your mistakes. Learn from what you, when you see there is harm, and making amends. So these times in our practice where, you know, even this is this, you know, in some ways in the question having the institutional delusions embedded in it, I'm interpreting it more from the relational realm. But even in our practice, when we are noticing what's happening, what's arising, there are times when we hit something that's like, wow, how do I meet this? Some thought arises and some huge story from the past comes up and it kind of overwhelms us. It's not that we're taking steps back. It's just this is coming up in awareness and the mind hasn't quite processed this yet. It's an edge of our practice. It's a place where learning can be found. Whenever we are meeting discomfort, you know, discomfort is the place where we learn the suffering of self, of others, of both. When we see that, that is where the learning happens. The simile of the raft, another flood analogy, basically. I haven't mentioned it, I don't think, on this retreat. But again, the flood is the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. And instead of this image of the Buddha walking across the flood, there's this encouragement to build a raft to help yourself get across the flood. And, you know, building a raft, you're building a raft out of what's around you. Just sticks and maybe some twine from the trees, or, you know, just lashing it all together and then like plopping that down on the water. It's like, you know, I'm just envisioning it being a pretty rickety thing. And you get on the raft and it says, make the effort with your hands and your feet to get across the flood. So you've got something to support you a little bit. You know, the raft supports you a little bit. And the flood is like, you know, you're in the water, basically. You're, you know, trying to navigate the flood. And the image in my mind, this image, while you're navigating the flood in this way, you're getting wet. You know, that this is how the crossing happens. We don't build this, and this comes from Ajahn Sumedho. He says something like, yeah, we don't build the super duper vehicle. You know, we don't build this like yacht to get us across the flood where we can be completely dry and comfortable all the way across. It is a raft. And it's probably falling apart as we're crossing the river, and like we're like maybe grabbing a stick that's floating down and trying to lash it on as we're going. It's a hard work, and it's going to be suffering, and it's going to be struggle. And yet, that is where that meeting of suffering is where the wisdom grows. And so, when it feels like you're taking two steps back, maybe it's like, ah, possible place for wisdom to grow here. Kind of like pointing to that place of the feeling of the uncontrollable, a pointer to not self. This kind of place where it's like, wow, feels like this is a big mess. I don't know what to do. It's like, oh, maybe there's something to learn here. In fact, there is something to learn here. So if the mind can turn towards that, the possibility of learning in these places, and the recognition that whenever we meet whatever kind of suffering or pain that we have, it is basically the places where we are still clinging, and that's what the Buddha pointed to over and over again. Understand the suffering. Understand it. That understanding begins to free the mind from its clingings. So my hope is that that perspective on what seems to be taking two steps back will offer a new way to relate to it. There's no need to lose hope when we run into suffering. In fact, suffering is how the whole journey gets started. Suffering is actually a supportive condition for freedom. When suffering is met with the teachings and a sense of confidence, engagement, faith that, oh, this is a way. We don't tend to step onto this path without the suffering. And the next question ties into that nicely. Can you speak more about the cycle, ? That starts with faith, delight, joy, tranquility, etc., that you mentioned last night? So I brought this into the reflection last night. This is a teaching on conditionality that points to, so that the Buddha's most broad teaching on conditionality is when this is, that is. When this arises, that arises. When this isn't, that isn't. When this ceases, that ceases. And there are different elaborations of that teaching, one of them being the teaching on dependent co-arising that I offered the other night, the description of how suffering comes to be. Another elaboration on that teaching starts from suffering, but instead of cycling back to ignorance, you know, that the dependent or the dependent co-arising teaching that describes the arising of suffering often considered as a cycle because it tends to happen until we meet some teachings that point a different way, that when we experience suffering, we double down on our strategies that tend to reinforce the whole cycle. We double down on our strategies of find the next permanent thing, get rid of this thing. How can I fix this? How can I control this? And so it tends to be that cycle until we meet some kind of teaching, something that says, hey, there's a possible different way. There's a different way to deal with suffering, a different way. And so there's another exposition, another teaching that basically describes how suffering, when met with basically a teaching that says freedom from suffering is possible, and an interest in kind of moving in that direction, it will lead to faith. And very naturally, there'll be a kind of a conditioned set of unfoldings that very naturally move from suffering to freedom. So I'll read the links and brought them with me. Suffering is a supportive condition for faith to arise. Faith is a supportive condition for delight. Delight, a supportive condition for joy. Joy, a supportive condition for tranquility. Tranquility for happiness. And I'll pause there because this is what I pointed to last night, that these first links in this teaching speak to the way these beautiful heart qualities are on the path. That the and very naturally on the path. There's another teaching that goes something like, when faith is present, there's no need for an act of will. May delight arise. It is the natural condition that when there is faith, delight will arise. When delight is present, there's no need for an act of will. May joy arise. When delight is present, joy naturally arises. And it goes through this entire chain in this way, this same set of steps that I'm just reading now. So there's this also this understanding of the very natural conditioning way of these wholesome qualities heading us in the direction of freedom. And in the sutta that describes these, there's this beautiful image of water running downhill, the streams of water naturally flowing down, gathering in little pools, collecting, overflowing, flowing down, gathering into bigger streams, gathering into rivers, and very organically just flowing in the direction of the ocean. And so the nature of the water is to flow downhill and join into other streams, head towards the ocean. And so in the same way, he says it's the nature of these qualities to support each other, to move in this direction towards freedom. And I love that these heart qualities are like the foundation in a way in this description. They're where the practice begins, faith, delight, and joy being heart qualities. But these arise because wisdom has come in. And so the suffering being met with a teaching that says there's a way towards freedom. And this description of dependent co-arising, suffering is created by craving, by clinging. That understanding leads the mind towards a sense of possibility, the sense of, oh, maybe there is a way out of this suffering. And so it is wisdom meeting that suffering that starts the path, but there's an immediate heart response. Faith, to me, is a heart response. Trust, a heart response. Delight, joy, heart response. Tranquility, kind of in between wisdom and heart, to me. This settling of the mind as it begins to kind of maybe have a little more trust in the whole thing going. And then happiness, again, a heart quality. And then the thing that happiness is a supportive condition for? Concentration. Is that what you thought? How to get to concentration? Find some happiness. Mostly we think, jump on the train and start working really hard. This points to relax, let these qualities inform you, and concentration comes more organically. And again, this concentration can be one-pointed concentration. It can be this more open kind of concentration that we're working with. And then from that concentration, we head into more wisdom, that concentration, and again, this is the pointing of the teachings, that concentration kind of needs to be aimed in the service of liberation, towards understanding suffering, towards seeing where we're confused. And so with concentration as a supportive condition, knowledge and vision of things as they are comes to be. And this is essentially understanding the truths of impermanent, unreliable not-self. When this teaching of understanding things as they actually are, when that phrase comes up in the suttas, it points to these understandings, the cultivations of the understandings that come from these perceptions that naturally leads the mind to start to let go. Knowledge and vision of things as they are, this seeing into impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, supports disenchantment. I talked about this yesterday afternoon. The next one supports dispassion, the other word we spent some time with yesterday. These both feel like the wisdom side again to me. Knowledge and vision of things as they are is the wisdom that arises from the concentration supported by the heart qualities, those beautiful heart qualities. Disenchantment. Although this one does have a kind of a flavor, thinking about it, disenchantment, disillusionment. It's like the heart's response to wisdom. It's like the terrain around disenchantment we spoke about, you know, a lot of different emotional kind of relationships to those truths. And so the path towards disenchantment does lead through the ways in which the heart is in relationship to those truths. And then dispassion, the wisdom of not picking up, the wisdom of releasing greed, aversion, delusion, that fading of the die, the fading of that sound of the bell. The next link is release. To me, the feeling of release is, we could say, is the heart taking in freedom. And the next link is knowledge of release. So these refer to full freedom here in this teaching. These refer to the complete release from greed, aversion, and delusion. And so that release part feels to me like the heart involved there. We think in terms of heart mind being two different things in the West, and yet what I'm hearing in the way that this teaching works is an interweaving of these two in liberation, an interweaving of things that we think of as heart, things that we think of as mental. Both support freedom. Both head us in this direction, and so release being the heart's experience of release. And the knowledge of release maybe is how that affects the mind. And it's also said there's sometimes a reviewing that happens there, that kind of like the mind processing release through its intellectual capacities, through its thinking processes, what the mind has understood in that release. And so again, this interweaving of heart and mind in this path to freedom. To me, it's a beautiful, beautiful reflection. Kind of inspires this description inspires me as this path of freedom as being a very integrated kind of the word that is popping in, it doesn't feel like quite the right word, is wholeness, but an integrated freedom. It's an integrated freedom. And what is let go of, what is released, is greed, aversion, and delusion. Following release from greed, aversion, and delusion, there's so many different expressions. It's so interesting to me the way that there's one teaching that kind of describes, somebody asked the Buddha to describe an awakened person. I wish I'd brought that with me. I had it yesterday for the talk and I didn't get to it, but I don't have it with me. It's a long poem kind of describing. So this person comes to Buddha and says, tell me what a free person is like. And the Buddha describes this person in terms of things they don't do, mostly. You know, so they don't lie, they don't, they're not petulant, they're not grasping after things. And so it's mostly described in things they don't do. Ways they are not in the world. And the descriptions, you can point back, you can see, oh yeah, there's, if that were happening, there would be greed in the mind. If that were happening, there would be aversion in the mind. And so this freedom, the release from greed, aversion, and delusion, as a description of what is let go of, not as like, oh, a person who's awakened becomes a perfectly peaceful person who walks around doing X, Y, or Z. That's not the description. And so the way that freedom is described gives a lot of room for personal expression of freedom. I've met people in monks in Burma. They seemed pretty free. I don't know how free they were, but just such different expressions of their freedom. One, so I spent quite a bit of time in the Sagaing Hills in Burma for a number of years, supporting a retreat there. And we would walk in the hills, and there's like many monasteries there, probably thousands of monasteries. You walk through the hills and there's just one monastery after another. And the people who kind of, the tradition of the retreat, the kind of the passing of the baton from hand to hand in terms of supporting the retreat, there were a couple of particular monks that we would tend to go visit. And one of them lived in a monastery. It was about a half an hour hike away. We'd walk up. And the first time I went, we were hiking along and kind of chatting and talking. And it was the group of the teachers and those of us who were supporting the retreat, the managers, the translator. We were all kind of walking together, about five or six of us. And as we came to the gate, the translator said to us, we need to be quiet now. And so we fell into silence. And as I walked through the gate, the monastery was kind of in a bowl. It's kind of like carved out. There were walls, rock walls on three sides of the monastery, and they were whitewashed. And it was a kind of a hush, I felt like, as we went in there. And I just felt like I entered into this ocean of tranquility. It changed my mind to just walk into the monastery. And then I met the monk who lived there. And he was so quiet. We would have conversations with him, but just his whole being was just like this pool of silence. And again, it changed my mind. It altered my mind. He was a very quiet being. We would ask him questions, and he would speak to us about the Dharma, and it was amazing, a lovely experience. I just felt so privileged to get to meet this person. And there was another one that we often went to visit, who lived a closer distance away, and he was getting pretty old. I think the last time I saw him, he was probably in his late 80s, maybe early 90s. And he was really happy. You know, that was that. You know, in terms of these links, you know, it's like one of them embodied tranquility, and the other one, joy and happiness. And so we'd go to visit him. And this last time I went to see him, the very last time I saw him, he had been ill, and we walked into his room, and we were speaking through a translator. But it's so interesting how it just felt like I was speaking directly to him. And we asked him how he was. And he said, oh, and kind of started laughing. Oh, yeah, I almost died yesterday. And, you know, he just was so delighted by everything. He laughed, and we asked to have a picture with him on one visit. We asked to have a picture of him, and the monks in Burma are told they're not supposed to smile when the pictures are taken. He couldn't do it. He kept having to put his hand in front of his mouth. He'd try to, you know, get his mouth down so that he wasn't showing his teeth, and then he would just burst into laughter again. So very different embodiments of freedom. In this case, both monks. But it's really opened my mind and my heart to, you know, the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion doesn't look one way. You know, some may choose to live in isolation, in seclusion, kind of like the one in that monastery that was further away. Others may choose to be more active. It's like that the expressions of freedom also join with our history, our conditioning, our whole, like, ways that we've been shaped, and produce different ways of responding in the world. To me, that's so beautiful. What is your expression of freedom? That feels like enough to me today, so I'll try to get to the other ones sometime tomorrow. So let's just sit for a moment.